Welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is going to be a good show. So I guess we got to start with some music. What kind of music should we play today? Well, there's this great drummer named Narada Michael Walden, who was the drummer at one point in the Mahavishnu Orchestra with John McLaughlin. Later on, Billy Cobham was the drummer in that band. Or maybe one went after the other. But anyways, he put an album out that was quite good, you know, from a jazz fusion point of view. And, you know, he had amazing musicianship. And so we'll play something from that. I think we'll play Saint and the Rascal, which features Jeff Beck on guitar. You know, the amazing guitar player that died not that long ago. So here is Saint and the Rascal from Narada Michael Walden's album Garden of Love Light. And I think lots of you out there are starting your gardens, those of you who like to garden. So let's hear this tune from an album called Garden of Love Light. Thank you.
This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
For decades, Richard Heinberg led the charge to get off fossil fuels. Now, he says, the renewable energy transition is failing. Is he giving up? Should we give up? Heinberg is author of 14 books like The End of Growth and Power Down. His most recent book is Power, Limits and Prospects for Human Survival. You may have seen Richard in documentaries like The End of Suburbia or Planet of the Humans and DiCaprio's 11th Hour. He was among the first bloggers in the energy and climate arenas with his Muse letter, now around issue 359. Richard is senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. From California, Richard Heinberg, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, hi, Alex. It's great to be talking with you again.
A strange reality is unfolding around you in California. I lived in L.A. way back, never heard of an atmospheric river. California was the sunny place you want to be, and it's not so much this year. The Silicon Valley, well, crashed its own bank, and there's hundreds of thousands of homeless. Why is it so weird in California these days?
Well, you know, actually living here, it doesn't seem nearly as weird as it gets portrayed in the news. Here in Santa Rosa, we've had a lot of rain this year, which is great because we've had drought in recent years. But our average annual rainfall in Santa Rosa is 34 inches. We've had 37 inches of rain so far, so we're just a little above the seasonal average, and that's great. That's where we need to be. So, yeah, there are some trees down, and some people have been seriously inconvenienced by all this rain, but, you know, it could be a lot worse.
All right, maybe a case of bad press. And in your latest newsletter published in February, it was called Converging Debt Crisis. Are the recent bank failures part of that?
Well, sadly, I think so. The larger crisis that we're looking at is that we have created enormous amounts of debt, government debt, corporate debt, household debt, on the basis of the assumption that the economy is always going to grow, or just about every year the economy is going to grow. But, you know, economic growth is something that can't go on forever. It has real-world implications. When the economy grows, we use more energy and materials. And reality is we live on a finite planet. Economic growth comes at the expense of other species and future generations in the final analysis. Yeah, we can tinker around the edges with improvements in efficiency and so on. But realistically, the economy is already too big. And at some point, it's going to be downsized by processes over which we have very little control, like resource depletion and biodiversity loss. So what happens when that kicks in? Well, a lot of the debt that we've racked up, based on the assumption of continued economic growth in the future, is going to come due, and it's not going to be pretty from a financial perspective. So is Silicon Valley Bank just an early warning of that? Well, you know, it's kind of like tying today's weather to climate change. Well, it's impossible to say how much it's related, but, you know, I like to keep the big picture perspective in mind.
So why do you say the renewable energy transition is failing?
Just from the standpoint of carbon emissions, what we're seeing currently is we're building lots more solar panels, wind turbines. Billions of dollars are being directed into increasing the manufacture of renewable energy infrastructure. And yet, carbon emissions are still increasing. We reached record-level carbon emissions in 2022. Even with all the effort that's being put into building renewables. So why is that? Well, once again, it goes back to economic growth. We're demanding that the economy continue to grow, which means we demand more energy. And the energy growth annually is greater than the new energy inputs from renewables. Now, yeah, we could just, you know, redouble our efforts, but how much would we actually have to do that? The best estimates that I've seen suggest that we would need to increase our funding for renewable energy by 5 times to 10 times what it is now. And that just doesn't seem to be on the horizon. So if we want to reduce carbon emissions, we're going to have to do something other than just building solar panels and wind turbines. We're going to actually have to start using less energy, and that means using less energy for things like transportation and manufacturing, because it's going to take a lot of energy to build all the solar panels and wind turbines, and not just the panels and turbines, but all the other renewable energy infrastructure or electrical infrastructure that will be needed. This is a huge subject, actually, and it's one that very few people really appreciate in its depth, because we're not just talking about, you know, switching out energy sources. We're also talking about switching out enormous amounts of energy-using infrastructure, because most of our energy-using infrastructure today was built around the energy sources that we had in the past, which were solid, liquid, and gaseous fuels, as opposed to electricity, which is what solar and wind produce. And we only use 20% of our energy in the form of electricity. The other 80% we use in the form of fuels. So the energy transition is not just about building panels and turbines. It's about basically shifting our whole industrial model away from its reliance on fossil fuels toward entirely different energy sources. That's a huge project, and realistically, it's going to take decades. But I don't see that we've even seriously started. And the sign that we have seriously started will be that we actually begin reducing carbon emissions.
You spent decades investigating the limits of energy on this planet with articles and books about coal and oil and gas depletion. In your newer work, I'm hearing as much concern about the limits of minerals. Why is that?
Well, here's another facet of the renewable energy transition. It's going to take a tremendous amount of a wide range of minerals in order to build all of this new infrastructure. Most people are generally aware that we're going to need a lot of lithium for batteries and so on. But, you know, something as simple as sand, I think we kind of tend to assume that there's a heck of a lot of sand in the world. We could never run out of that. But actually, we need very specific forms of sand for producing silicon or even for producing concrete. You know, concrete is really the foundation of industrial civilization. And we use concrete also for anchoring wind turbines. So we'll need a lot of concrete in order to build all of this new infrastructure. Do we have enough sand? Well, it turns out we need very specific kinds of sand. The granules of sand have to be angular. They can't be all eroded and round. That just doesn't make very good concrete. It needs to be very pure if we're going to make silicon. Those special kinds of sand are actually getting very scarce. So that's just one mineral resource that we're going to need a heck of a lot of in the coming decades. And we have to understand also, if we insist on more economic growth, that also means vastly greater quantities of minerals. Over the last few decades, we've been doubling the size of the human economy every 25 years. That's the real-world implication of 2 to 3% economic growth annually. So doubling the size of the economy every 25 years also means that the amount of waste we're producing has doubled every 25 years. So can we continue that doubling rate out into the next few decades as we're also building all of this new infrastructure for the renewable energy transition? It's just an enormous project. Realistically, I don't think much of it's going to happen. I believe we really do need to build solar panels and wind turbines to produce electricity so that we have functioning electricity grids, maybe slimmed down grids in the future. But if we let the grids go, if the transition fails completely, then the result will be that we'll lose civilization itself, because everything's been digitized. All our scientific knowledge, all of our financial records, everything has been digitized. So if the grid goes down once and for all, we're pretty much done for. So we've got to keep the grids up and running, and that means we'll need renewable electricity. But are we going to be able to also have enough renewable electricity for you know, electric aircraft and all the other amenities that some of us might like to have. Realistically, I don't think so.
In your recent article at resilience.org, you introduce us to Simon Michaud at the Finnish Geological Survey. Simon wrote a report with quite a long title, but it's worth it, Assessment of the Extra Capacity Required of Alternative Energy Electrical Power Systems to Completely Replace Fossil Fuels. What did Michaud discover about our big plans for an energy transition?
Well, Michaud is an expert on mineral resources. He's with the Finnish Geological Survey. And he crunched the numbers and came to the conclusion that we simply don't have enough mineral resources to accomplish the renewable energy transition. Now, that conclusion has been criticized by some other researchers. So I guess you could say, in one sense, that we still don't know. But I have to say, even if Michaud is off by a factor of two, let's say we have twice as many mineral resources as he thinks we do, how much longer does that give us? Well, if we keep doubling the size of the global economy every 25 years, that gives us another 25 years. There are some French researchers who assumed a perfect rates of recycling, you know, recycling minerals and metals as well as we possibly can. And there are some practical limits on recycling because as we recycle many materials, they degrade over time. So it's impossible to have 100% recycling. But they assumed recycling at the highest levels currently technically feasible. And in their view, there are enough minerals for us to operate a renewable energy economy of the current scale of the global economy for about 200 to 300 years before we just finally run out of everything. So, you know, that's kind of the best possible case, because currently we aren't recycling anything at close to the maximum rates, and it will take us not just a technical revolution, but I think a social and economic revolution to get to the point where we're actually operating our economy on the basis of renewable energy and recycling everything at optimum rates. We're so far from that situation now that we're really talking about hypotheticals.
And this renewable energy revolution depends on a system of global cooperation and trade. I mean, lithium comes from one place and the chips come from somewhere else. Instead, we're seeing a split into major blocks. There's one war in progress, another possible. There are trade sanctions on some materials that you need for wind and solar. Richard, should we see the geopolitical divide as an important stumbling block for really getting renewable products and power?
Well, I'm sad to say, yes, it very likely is. Michael Clare is a scholar who's been working on this subject for a long time. He has books like The Race for What's Left and Resource Wars, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet. And in these books that he's written, he argues, I think, very persuasively that as our need for minerals and metals increases, and as geopolitical tensions mount over access to those resources, we're going to see the current kinds of geopolitical fault lines really run much deeper, and we could see a new round of wars on a scale that we haven't seen since the world wars of the 20th century. You know, the last few decades have seen a lot of regional conflicts, smaller scale conflicts. But generally speaking, we've had a period of relative world peace that has enabled lots of economic growth and a lot of general optimism about what we can do as human beings on this planet. But if we're going to continue with that kind of Pax Americana, is what some people have called it, because it's the U.S. as the global superpower that has sort of maintained this global level of peace. If we're going to continue that, it's going to require new mechanisms for conflict resolution that we currently don't have. And that's going to require compromise on all sides. It's going to require a general recognition that if we descend into resource conflict, then all of the problems that we're facing are going to get much, much worse. We'll have no chance at really solving climate change while maintaining industrial levels of production. It's really the worst of all possible worlds.
Is there any way to depoliticize this project to save civilization and our environmental home?
Well, we're going to have to depoliticize a lot of things, and I think that's going to have to start at the local level. You know, we're going to have to start talking to each other as people instead of woke or MAGA or, you know, left or right. We're all human beings. We all eat. We all have loved ones. We all have a stake in having a survivable future. Reality is reality, regardless of what you think about it. And in reality, we live on a finite planet. Some of us may love fossil fuels, but the reality is that they're finite. They're running out. We've had this fracking revolution over the last 10, 15 years that has enabled the U.S. to produce more oil and gas faster than at any time in our previous U.S. history. Our U.S. oil production grew by, 7 million barrels a day or something like that in 10 years? Nothing like that in previous world history, you know. But that's coming to an end. Even the Wall Street Journal now is saying that the fracking revolution is running on fumes. Post-Carbon Institute, we did a series of reports over the last several years showing that this would just be a short-term, you know, shot in the arm for the oil and gas industry. It's really the last hurrah because it's, you know, the industry has always gone after the easiest to get, highest quality resources first. And when we're talking about shale gas and tight oil, these are not the best, easiest, cheapest to get resources. These are the bottom of the barrel. And yeah, they have been a shot in the arm for the industry over the last 10 years, but over the next few years, we're going to see declining production in all of these resource plays, the Bakken, the Eagle Ford, even the Permian in Texas is starting to top out. And when that happens, then global oil production is going to start declining for purely geological reasons, regardless of what we do about climate change. And then, you know, well, whose fault is that? Well, I'm sure that some people will say we're just not investing enough and, oh, it's because the government has put all these restrictions on drilling and so on. But, you know, the reality is we're just running out.
You and I see energy descent as fundamental to any effort to save ourselves. The Secretary General of the United Nations surely agrees. Instead, Joe Biden just authorized a huge drilling project by ConocoPhillips in the farthest north Arctic of Alaska. And these fossil fuels will not come online until 2029 or 2030, the years when every major agency and institution says we need to be slashing fossil fuels, not adding more. The UK government just approved more gas fracking. Everybody's plunging into a dead planet future. How do you see all this?
Frankly, I think it's inevitable as long as we maintain this misguided view that we have to grow the economy and that the future has to look like the last few decades. You know, everybody has to have a car. We've got to be constantly buying more consumer products in order to grow the economy so everybody has a job. You know, this is an economic system that traces back to the 1930s. When we had a depression caused by overproduction, and everybody got together, industrialists and government politicians, they all got together and said, well, we've got to fix this. How do we do it? Well, we've got to encourage consumption. And consumerism was born with advertising and consumer credit to encourage people to go into debt so they could afford to buy stuff that they otherwise couldn't. And so we've had this growth machine in operation ever since. And now it's just baked into everybody's worldview, whether you're an economist or a politician or just somebody who runs a grocery store. The assumption is the economy's continually got to grow. And the only way it does is with more energy. And where do we get our energy currently? From fossil fuels. So as long as we maintain this mindset, there's going to be the demand for more fossil fuels. So it's not just, as I was saying earlier, it's not just a matter of building more panels and turbines. we've got to change that fundamental mindset, this dependency on growth that we've baked into our institutions. That's the only thing that's going to get us off of fossil fuels.
What happened to the degrowth movement?
Well, it's actually alive and well in Europe, not so much in the U.S. It never got off the ground in the U.S., and it's easy to understand why, because it's the U.S. is where the whole economic growth mania started. It's the country where it's most institutionally baked into how we do business and how we do government. So, you know, it's really hard to get Americans to question growth. But, you know, you go elsewhere in the world and people, there are a lot of people who get it, and they're reorganizing their lives to use less and to depend less on money even. You know, I mean, we assume that money makes the world go round. Of course, well, it's really energy that makes makes the world go round. But, you know, as we depend more and more on money, we use more resources, we alienate ourselves more and more from the natural world and so on. There are a lot of people who get it.
Yep. Just for listener information, there's a degrowth workshop. Well, there was one 26 February in Melbourne, Australia, but there's another conference, Beyond Growth 2023, May 15th in the European Parliament in Brussels. And then the 9th International Degrowth Conference will take place in late August in Zagreb, Croatia. So it's still going. It's too bad that we don't hear more about it, as you say, in the United States or Canada. So, Richard, maybe the current stock and banking system will crash into a major depression. People would make do with less because they have to. Could that help us?
Well, you know, I hate to be the person who says, yes, it could help, because, of course, that makes it sound like I'm rooting for lots of people to lose everything they have and go from getting by to suffering. I don't want anybody to have to suffer. But the reality is we have an economic system that's designed to fail. Given the finite nature of global resources, global energy, and given the necessity for further growth that's baked into the financial institutions themselves, we're on a collision course. There could be an upside to that if we foresee it, if we plan for it, if we start to remake those institutions now ahead of the crisis. Then we could build a world, a post-growth world, where we depend less on, as I was saying earlier, depend less on money and depend more on each other and on the health of global ecosystems. So is that happening? Again, it is happening in some places. And if you go to, you know, somewhere like Costa Rica, you're going to see a very different reality from what you see, you know, New York or Los Angeles. And it's in the places, I think, where we refuse to acknowledge limits that we're going to see the most suffering. And again, I don't want to see anyone have to suffer because of all of this, but I'm afraid we're setting ourselves up for it.
Do you think rationing is a way to make this smaller pie more fairly distributed?
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up, because I definitely think that rationing is in our future, and rationing could be a great way to get ourselves through this bottleneck. What is rationing? Well, it's a way of apportioning scarce resources so that everybody has what they need, and that's exactly what we need. We've had rationing during both world wars. In Britain, they had rationing for many years after the end of the Second World War, because they were still recovering and still experiencing scarcity. And here's the thing. During rationing in Britain, as they were rationing food, for example, people were actually better nourished with rationing than they were prior to or after rationing. Again, everybody had what they needed. And currently, everybody doesn't have what they need. We have extreme economic inequality and growing economic inequality. And if we try to maintain that, you know, that level of freedom for those with too much to get even more, then those who are at the bottom of the economic pile are just going to, you know, fall off altogether, and the human toll could be just horrific. The way to overcome that is with rationing, and rationing builds social cohesion. If it's fair, that's the key. It has to be fair and it has to be transparent. But if it is, people can get on board and understand this is for the good of everyone, and seeing that they're getting their basic needs met, they'll go along.
Two-part question. Do you still have chickens? And has a flame of post-carbon survived in communities in California?
Yeah, we still do have chickens. We're down to two right now. Unfortunately, a couple of our chickens passed away last year, but we're hoping to revive our flock this year. And yeah, there are fewer, I think, communities in California that are calling themselves, you know, post-carbon outposts. Back 10, 15 years ago, we had a program along those lines, and then there were the transition towns, which we helped to promote. And I don't see quite as many of those sort of grassroots community-level organizing efforts going on now, which is a shame, because we need it now more than ever. So I don't know what the next organizing model will be to get people working. Hopefully that wasn't just a generational phenomenon where, you know, the baby boomers were more into doing that kind of thing and the next generation is less so. Because, you know, that's absolutely what's required. We've got to get together on a community level to build social resilience, to build social trust, because that's what gets us through when times get tough. My wife and I learned that when we had the fires here in Santa Rosa a few years ago. It was our neighbors who came to our aid, and it was with our neighbors that we celebrated the passing of the fires, and we had community cookouts and celebrations, and it was enormously healing. I think that's where we have to put our emphasis.
From the California coast, we've been speaking with one of the original post-carbon visionaries, Richard Heinberg. You can find him at richardheinberg.com. I recommend his newsletter and his books. Richard, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure speaking with you, Alex. Thank you. Take care.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Net zero, blah, blah, blah. Actually, the world's biggest banks are funding more fossil fuels, not less. Projects to heat Earth beyond 2 degrees C are probably already on the drawing boards, funded and underway. Spurred on by the biggest profits ever seen on this planet, this crazy fossil fuel bonanza spreads from the deep seabed, through the Amazon jungle, right into the far Arctic. Are your savings helping to kill a livable climate? You need to know. All the sad and sorry facts, naming names, is found in a new report called Banking on Climate Chaos, Fossil Fuel Finance Report 2023. This comes from a consortium of nonprofit groups, The Watchers. Our guide is Dr. April Merlot, Director of Research for Rainforest Action Network. Merlot is the author of the 2015 book American Empire and the Cultural Politics of Sweetness. From Massachusetts, April Merlot, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Right. So in 2022, the big five oil and gas companies reported over $200 billion in profits, the most ever, and that's just the big five. Are we living in a new fossil fuel boom, and what is driving it?
It really does look like we're living in a new fossil fuel boom. Certainly last year, one of the things that was driving it was the conflict in the Ukraine. Russia's invasion of the Ukraine really drove energy prices to all-time highs. And I think whenever there are big profits to be had, big corporations, those oil and gas companies, are happy to rush towards those profits. So we saw lots of companies that had proposals, particularly for liquefied natural gas, but for some other of the dirty unconventional oil and gas sectors. Also, plans that they had kind of put on the shelves for a few years suddenly started dusting those off last year when they started to see prices going a lot higher, and really jumped on that moment to expand liquefied natural gas and other fossil fuels that we know we just can't, not only don't need, but really can't stand to extract and burn if we're going to stay within our climate goals.
Do you think the big banks and the fossil fuel companies know what happens if they go ahead with their expansion plans as far as the climate goes?
That's a hard question. We've got pretty good evidence that fossil fuel companies have known for a long time that burning fossil fuels increases concentrations of greenhouse gases, and that those greenhouse gases are heating up the planet, and that's likely to make it unlivable for all of us. And the fact that we know that they've known that for a while makes me not particularly trust them. So, for example, we sometimes hear from banks that they want to fund their clients to transition away from fossil fuels and to take the lead on a decarbonized economy. And I don't share that trust in fossil fuel companies to be able to lead us towards a decarbonized future, given that they've brought us to where we are right now. Banks, I think, have a little bit better chance of being taken seriously in their climate commitments. We have definitely seen some movement among banks, the biggest global banks in the last few years, in terms of beginning to articulate some climate commitments. Those climate commitments continue to be not ambitious enough to meet the challenges of the moment. And in many cases, we see loopholes that allow them to continue financing fossil fuel companies and raking in the profits that we know can come from those, particularly in times of high geopolitical conflict, like last year with the conflict in Ukraine.
This expansion, as your report makes clear, is going on all over the globe. And my studio is near Vancouver, Canada, so let's start here. We know the Alberta tar sands are among the most carbon-intensive fuels in the world, and you should read that as the most polluting. Who is paying to keep them going and even fund new projects there?
I mean, unequivocally, the top Canadian banks are the ones that are behind the development of the tar sands financing, the key companies that are doing the work there. So we see something like 88% of financing for tar sands companies is coming from those main Canadian banks, RBC, Scotiabank, TD. Those are the key actors financing the tar sands companies.
Yeah, but they're all in there. The Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, Scotiabank, Bank of Montreal. Basically, that means everyone with a bank account in Canada is funding tar sands climate wrecking, whether we know it or not. Shouldn't the banks at least disclose their toxic investments? Maybe we should have to sign off. Yes, I agree. I will pay for the tar sands and the climate wreckage.
Yeah, unequivocally, I think that's spot on. And I think that's the sort of absolute minimum ask, is for banks to be disclosing in a much more clear way exactly where their financing is going. And in addition to that, really setting much more ambitious kinds of targets for how they're going to decarbonize the portfolios that they've got. So we see RBC expanding their financing to major tar sands companies like Cenovus and Enbridge, right? Those two companies got $20.8 billion in financing in 2022 from the 60 banks covered in our report. But again, the lead banks on that are just across the board Canadian banks.
For me, the most frightening fossil fuel projects are appearing in the Arctic. Everybody knows the Arctic is warming four times faster than the rest of the planet. If that permafrost thaws and releases all the carbon stored there, we are literally toast. I thought there was some sort of unspoken agreement against exploiting the Arctic, but why? New projects like the Willow in North Alaska, they're happening right now. Why is that?
Your guess is as good as mine why anybody thinks that's a good idea. I understand that in order to accomplish that, they even have to refreeze part of the permafrost because the drilling equipment needs to have the permafrost frozen, and the fossil fuels that are it's extracting, the burning of them is making that permafrost thaw. So it just defies all logic as far as I am concerned. One of the things, and I'm glad you brought it up, because we see loopholes in bank policies. So banks are able to, what really looks like greenwash through some of their policies. We saw a number of banks over the last few years issue Arctic exclusion policies, so saying that they wouldn't fund projects for oil and gas extraction in the Arctic. There are a couple loopholes around that. The first loophole is the one that we see with the Willow project, which is that those exclusion policies specify that they won't give project finance. Well, project finance is a very specific kind of financial transaction where the proceeds are designated for a particular project. It gets written into the balance sheet in a particular kind of way. The use of proceeds are really clearly articulated for that kind of finance. unfortunately or fortunately, depending on which perspective you've got, only 4% of the transactions that we've got in our data set are project finance. So that means if a bank has made a policy and said, we won't finance any projects in the Arctic, so only 4% of all of our deals are project finance and thus would be applicable to that. So instead, more typically, what we see is oil and gas companies and coal companies too, instead of asking for project finance, they borrow money either through a loan or they issue a bond, and the use of proceeds is designated as for general corporate purposes. So they don't specify a project that they're going to apply that to. They just say, we're going to use this for general corporate purposes. It's going to go where it needs to go to facilitate our ongoing business. So that's the case with Willow. ConocoPhillips received financing from several of the major banks. I think a syndicate of 12 banks lent money to ConocoPhillips in 2022. That financing was all with the use of proceeds designated as for general corporate purposes rather than project-specific finance. So that Arctic exclusion policies that some of those banks had didn't apply in that case. The other big loophole that we see with the Arctic is the geographic designation. So the few banks that do have policies will define the Arctic as the Arctic Circle. So they draw that perfect circular line. Well, that's not really environmentally or politically or economically accurate. If you look at the definition of the Arctic that has been articulated by the Arctic Council, which is the international body that governs the Arctic, the geographic designation is much broader. It's much more complex, so a little bit harder to navigate. And we see a significant number of assets, between 100 and 200 oil and gas extraction assets are located within the Arctic, outside of the Arctic Circle, but within that Arctic Council definition of the Arctic. So we see lots of loopholes like this in bank policies and just see this as a way that they're greenwashing, telling us on the one hand that they're addressing the climate crisis and on the other hand continuing to engage in business as usual with their fossil fuel clients.
Many of my listeners are concerned about the Amazon rainforest. We need to conserve that massive carbon sink, and it's a pool of species found nowhere else on the planet, and some people actually live there and they have rights. But there is more planet wrecking going on than just deforestation or fires. Tell us about the growing role of oil and gas extraction in the Amazon.
Really glad to be able to incorporate an assessment of bank financing for, in this case, 21 companies where we have evidence of direct involvement in oil and gas extraction in the Amazon biome in Brazil, Ecuador, Peru, and Colombia. So again, like with the Arctic, we use a more expansive, environmentally appropriate definition of the Amazon biome. So the Amazonian Geo-Referenced Socio-Environmental Information Network's definition of the Amazon biome. If you use that definition as opposed to the vague and really not kind of not precise definitions that the few banks that do have Amazon policies use, lots of extraction going on there. So we see Santander, a Spanish bank, is the top financier of Amazon oil and gas extraction. But some U.S. banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citi, Bank of America, also have exposure in that region. We see some really pretty reckless projects happening. GeoPark is a big driller in the Colombian Amazon, really has a bad track record of environmental and social issues and a long history of resistance and fight from indigenous folks on the ground. Frontera, Gran Tierra, a couple other companies that are drilling. And we just know that in places like Amazonia, where there's a high level of biodiversity, and that biodiversity is standing in the way of extracting oil and gas, we see forest destruction, and we see companies just plowing over the rights of indigenous peoples, human rights, just tremendous pollution and irreparable damage that happens as a result of this.
It's lawlessness in the jungle, and it's being funded by banks that we know and perhaps are invested in.
You
are tuned to Radio EcoShock, now broadcast by over 60 college and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Britain, and Australia. I'm Alex Smith saying, as we head into a crisis of energy, economy, and the environment, we need alternative voices more than ever. Please support your local nonprofit station. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest from the Rainforest Action Network is April Merlot, Director of Research. We're talking about the new Banking on Climate Chaos Fossil Fuel Finance Report 2023. April, as American coal miners go bankrupt and coal's share of electricity production falls in the U.S., we think of coal in the past tense. But what did your report find out about financing of coal in China and India?
Coal financing does seem to be declining. The cost of capital for coal developers is increasing, which I think is a good sign in some ways, because the more expensive it is to produce coal, the more likely folks are to stop producing it because it's reflecting the true cost to our society. We do see with coal power, the investments that continue to go in, or the financing that continues to go in to support coal power, are predominantly coming from Chinese banks. So we've got 13 Chinese banks in the scope of our report, and the vast majority of the financing to coal power is coming from those banks. Unfortunately, it's not just those banks. We do see a handful of other banks, including, as you said, the State Bank of India, but also still having some exposure are some U.S. banks, so J.P. Morgan Chase, Citi, and a couple of Japanese banks, including Mizuho, SMBC, MUFG. So those are the three big Japanese mega banks also still putting some money into coal power. Similarly, a handful of Canadian banks last year put some money into coal mining. Yeah, far too many banks still with exposure to coal mining, given the urgency of the coal phase out. I mean, you mentioned coal miners. I think I would just add in there that one of the real issues, I think, with the continued financing of coal mining is that really every dollar that goes towards financing coal mining is a dollar that's not going to creating those really good jobs that I hope are right on the horizon in the clean energy and a more just, people-centered energy system that really has the potential to create a lot of jobs and help pivot in a much more just way for the workers that are impacted by a phase out of fossil fuels. So there's a real opportunity here, I think, to have a just transition where it's not like we're just kicking people out of jobs, but really thinking about what the new jobs are going to be, asking our financial institutions to shift their financing priorities so that they're enabling that new economy and those new jobs.
And your groups found bank financing to fossil fuel companies did not go up in 2022. Is that not good news, a sign that these banks get the message, they're living up to their green pledges?
So there's one bank where I think it's good news, and that's La Banque Postale, French bank that made a commitment in 2021 to stop financing fossil fuels. And as a result of that commitment, we saw zero financing from them in 2022. Our data set doesn't have any deals with fossil fuel companies for 2022. For the rest of the banks, including those whose financing for fossil fuels decreased in 2022, it's very difficult for me to see that as the beginning of a long-term trend, as much as it's probably, unfortunately, going to be an outlier. I don't see any evidence that it's the result of intentional policy decisions or changes in practices in those major banks. Instead, I think it's attributable to things that are going on out in the world. So higher prices for fossil fuels really drove up those profits, as you mentioned, at the head of the show. Fossil fuel companies making really remarkable, outstanding levels of profit just didn't need to turn to banks for financing last year to the same degree that they have in the past. So that's certainly one factor, is fossil fuel companies not borrowing as much. You know, other things like interest rates being slightly higher, the dollar being strong against other currencies, those certainly are factors as well, shaping the financing numbers. I just unfortunately don't think that bank policies are robust enough to explain the decline in financing. And I think the fossil fuel industry is on the brink of expanding yet again, and so we're likely to see an increase in 2023. And according to data that was compiled by our partner organization, Oil Change International, it looks like the fossil fuel industry is gearing up for a big expansion in terms of the number of barrels, billions of barrels of oil equivalent that come to a final investment decision in 2024. So we're expecting really a surge in fossil fuel financing in the next couple of years, unless something really changes in bank policies, unless government policy pushes banks to tighten up their lending and financing activities. But this is just really such a crucial moment, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, for speeding up the transition away from fossil fuels.
Yeah, this is one sad part in a way. It's almost like we're not fighting to stop fossil fuels and to slash them. We have to cut fossil fuel emissions in half by 2030, according to the United Nations, or risk a dangerous climate. What we're fighting now is the mad expansion of fossil fuels to burn even more, to accelerate this whole awful process.
Yeah, I mean, it's really just unconscionable to be expanding at all. And there's no way that we can stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, which, of course, is the point at which we know that the impacts are going to become exponentially more difficult and more expensive, honestly, to adapt to.
April Merlot, could you just list out the groups who are behind this Banking on Climate Chaos report?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It's really quite a remarkable process. There are 7 co-authoring organizations, so it's a big report. Lots of work goes into making it. So Rainforest Action Network is the lead organization here. We also work really closely with the Indigenous Environmental Network, with Bank Track, which is an NGO in Europe, Oil Change International, Reclaim Finance, Sierra Club, and Ergobald.
Yes, we had the founder of Ergobald on Radio EcoShock. It's a great German environmental organization. What are the members of this coalition asking the world to do?
So we conclude the report with a recommendation specifically for banks. And those, I think based on our conversation, those recommendations aren't very difficult, really. So the first one is prohibit all finance for fossil fuel expansion immediately. Banks really need to just stop. They need to draw a really clear line, and that needs to apply to companies, not just projects. All those loopholes I was talking about earlier need to be cut out of those banking policies. We've seen a lot in the last couple of years of banks talking about their emissions reduction targets and their net zero targets, and I think on the one hand, that's very hopeful. On the other hand, we see many of those targets lacking ambition, and so we call on banks to adopt absolute financed emissions targets, so really rigorous targets that are going to lead to a reduction in the absolute emissions of their clients. We call on them to demand robust transition plans for all of their fossil fuel clients, including the existing ones, not just new ones. We call on them to protect the rights of indigenous peoples and human rights. And we call on them to really dramatically scale up their financing for a just and fair transition. So not too many demands, but a lot goes into making those realities. We know these are really complex institutions that do a lot of work to keep the global economy moving, but also have the potential to really support some pretty harmful projects on the ground. And really, I think as customers of those institutions, we all have the right and the obligation to be asking those institutions to live up to the promise of keeping our planet livable.
Yes, recently a few banks in the United States collapsed. The government made the depositors whole to avoid a cascade of bank failures. It was shaky. And it turns out the troubles came when people came and companies came and withdrew their money. And it sounds like we little people may have more power than we know. But as you've said, it's pretty hard to find a clean option. Maybe credit unions or maybe a few banks will offer themselves as real alternatives. We can hope.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think credit unions certainly are often a good option, and I do think there's a growing demand for banks that really have washed their hands of fossil fuels, and so hopefully that will be something that we can turn to. And also, hopefully, some of the big banks really will take seriously this obligation to be facilitating a rapid transition. On the bank failures, I would just say, you know, one of the big issues that was going on there is short-sightedness about evaluating some of the risks that were on the horizon. And I know I mentioned this before, but I really do see one of the jobs that banks need to do in order to be viable and in order to be fulfilling their mission in our society is to be evaluating risks. So the banking crisis in the United States has, to me, more than anything, just reiterated that fact that managing risks, including the climate risk, should be really top of the agenda for these financial institutions.
Well, now that the 2023 report is out, what else are you working on for RAND?
Well, you know, there's so much work building this data set that I haven't quite had as much time as I would like to dig in and find all the patterns that there are. It's a huge data set, so I'm looking forward to playing around in the data set to identify what other trends might be going on that we hadn't picked up on yet. And I'll probably write a couple of other reports over the next couple of months. I'm certainly interested in writing a report about the loopholes that I was talking to you about, trying to understand a little bit more clearly how those loopholes are enabling banks to continue business as usual. Also really interested to think about the relationship between bank policies and the financing they offer. So our report incorporates some really great analysis of bank policies that's done by our partners at Reclaim Finance and BankTrack. And so really looking forward to trying to figure out how to effectively assess the relationship between those bank policies and the actual financing banks are putting out.
Well, the report's easy to read, lots of good graphics. Where can our listeners download it?
Yeah, so we've got a beautiful website called bankingonclimatechaos.org, and you can explore the data. There's some data downloads. There's the full PDF of the report that you can download. It includes, in addition to the data and to the policy assessment, frontline stories, so stories from folks who are fighting really disastrous fossil fuel build-out around the world, including in liquefied natural gas in Africa and Asia and the United States, North America.
From the Rainforest Action Network, we've been speaking with Dr. April Merlot, Director of Research. Find more links and my notes to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you for throwing light on this matter, April.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Radio EcoShock, bringing you voices that matter. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening again this week and caring about our world.
You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Ryan Young. So that's all the time we have left in the show. We're going to leave you with some music, but you can always email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca to give us comments or suggestions. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/equilibriumckutmontreal. We have a website which is called equilibriumradio.weebly.com, and we have an affiliated podcast on Spotify called the Equilibrium Radio Podcast. So we'll leave you with some music here. What should we play? I guess we'll play a new tune by Hannah Georges. This is "This Too Shall Pass."
It's not my place to divulge, but I can't help it. After you leave, I feel guilty, but I know I meant it. Don't think it will change.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Blog, you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.